This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. It's hard to put your finger on when it just happened. Cell phones have taken over our lives. The first users were considered show-offs, lugging phones the size of bricks and making phone calls from the middle of restaurants while the rest of us still search for a public payphone. But for more than a decade, the phones have been shrinking and their popularity exploding. The most recent survey from the Pew Center for People and the Press says that cell phone use is now more widespread than internet use in the United States. In many other parts of the world, it's even more popular. So, how did we get here, and what does it mean? Are cell phones just the portable adjunct to the internet age, or are we undergoing a deeper revolution? Has the cell phone finally turned the world into something we can fit in our pockets? We want to hear from you. How have cell phones transformed your life? Are they more of a distraction than they're worth? And what do you want to see in the cell phone future? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And I guess it's a statement to our own backwardness that we don't have a text messaging service on our cell phones to take a text message question, but maybe as we get more advanced here at NPR, that'll be in the next iteration of this program. Paul Levinson is the author of a new book about the cell phone revolution. It's called Cell Phone, The Story of the World's Most Mobile Medium and How It Has Transformed Everything. He joins us from our New York bureau. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So we always think of the personal computer as the premier technological advancement of the recent decades, but you make a different argument. Why is the cell phone more important than the PC, do you think?
Because if you look at life in the 1990s, when the personal computer was at its zenith, people were able to go all over the world in cyberspace, but they were stuck in their seats as far as the real world is concerned. We were like flies on flypaper, unable to get out of the office or our homes. That was the price we had to pay to go online and surf the web. What the cell phone does is it allows us all of those things, but it doesn't keep us tied to our home. So we can walk through the world, we can feel the sun in our face, we can feel the breeze, we can be out navigating the full real world and still be connected.
But in a way, the cell phone does pin us down, because once upon a time you go out for a bike ride or you go for a walk and nobody can reach you. And now you go for a bike ride or go for a walk and you might just as well be sitting in your armchair at home next to the telephone.
Well, it's true. It pins us down psychologically, but not physically. And so that there you have both the disadvantage and the advantage of the cell phone. It is good for us as flesh and blood human beings to be able to freely, physically go through the world and still be in touch. But there's no doubt, as you're suggesting, that the price we pay for this is that we are psychologically always in touch. And I think being able to say no to being in touch, that is, being able to refuse a communication, will emerge and is already beginning to emerge as a new important social right.
Well, it's interesting, that point. People get very annoyed. There were these home answering machines where you could hear the caller and they start to leave a message and then someone picks up. And I know a lot of people in that circumstances feel annoyed that their calls are being screened and they're only getting through if they're the right person. But do you think that that annoyance has to go away? I mean, do we have to get used to being able to just say no?
Yes, we do. We're coming from a history where information and communication, especially long distance, was scarce. So when the phone rang, we paid attention to it because it was something that was still a little bit out of the ordinary. But with a cell phone in everyone's pocket, and with everyone therefore being able to both call anytime and receive a call anytime, the tradition of scarce communication has become reversed and it's turned inside out. And now communication is ubiquitous. And in order to make the most of it and maintain our humanity, we have to look at communication differently, and most especially be willing to say no. The phone is ringing. You know, in my case, I'm also a science fiction author, so every time the phone rings, it could be Steven Spielberg, who finally saw the light and wants to make a big movie out of one of my books, but I have to resist the impulse to answer the phone.
Now, you're a professor and teach communications and media studies at Fordham University in New York. Have you been noticing in your classrooms a shift in people's attitudes towards cell phones as you talk about the essential items in their lives?
Well, one of the great things about being a professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University is that students love to talk about what they're doing with their lives, including communication. So there's almost no more spirited discussion in a classroom, and I just finished teaching a class a couple of days ago, than the cell phone. But meanwhile, at the same time, it does provide challenges for classroom teaching, because you have to make it clear to students that, in general, barring an emergency call, it's not appropriate to talk on the cell phone in your class. Although I do admit that as a professor, I occasionally keep my cell phone on if I'm expecting an interview from some important newspaper or radio or television station.
Now, you make the point in your book that it's tempting to think of the corded telephone as the immediate precursor of the cellular telephone, but that's not really the right way to think about it. What do you think is the real precursor of the cell phone?
Well, the corded telephone is a partial precursor, but there is also a whole tradition of mobile media that the cell phone draws upon and is really the rightful descendant of. And it's just a question of how far back you want to go. Going back into ancient history, the first time that someone began writing on a tablet that could be carried somewhere, in contrast to carving on a cave wall or the side of a pyramid, that was a portable medium, and that changed civilization because it made information much more accessible. And more recently, near the end of the 19th century, when George Eastman introduced the Kodak camera, which people could carry around and take pictures any place, well, that was clearly the predecessor of today's cell phone and its ability, for better or worse, to take photographs everywhere. In the 20th century, the transistor radio in the 1950s, which came about because transistors replaced vacuum tubes, which were huge stationary devices. You couldn't move a radio very far if it had to operate on vacuum tubes. So the transistor in the 50s mobilized radio and allowed people eventually, if not to put it in their pocket, to certainly put it in their pocketbooks in some cases and to carry it around. The cell phone is the current incarnation of that whole branch of media evolution.
We're talking about the cell phone and how it's changed our lives. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us at totn@npr.org. I'm sorry, we're now supposed to say npr.org because .org is old style. We're trying to be very with the times here at NPR. Or it maybe I should say nipper. Well, never mind. That's too complicated. Let's go and invite some callers to join this conversation. George in Durham, North Carolina, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I've really had a nice, enjoyable time with my cell phone over the past decade. But I've got to say that as long as there are improvements in connectivity, especially with in families, and improvement in safety as you travel, the cell phone industry still needs a long way to go as far as coverage. Even here in Durham, North Carolina, there are places within the city limits where you have no coverage.
So, well, that's a very good point. When miracles come about, we get tired of them very quickly, and we want even newer and better miracles. The first modems, for example, operated at about 300 BPS. Now those seem painfully and impossibly slow. I mean, even a 56,000 BPS modem is very slow. And so the cell phone originally and still is a wonderful device, but the more we use it, the more we crave it being available and usable every single inch of the world.
So, George, are you on a cell phone right now?
Indeed, I am, and I've used it for a lot of calling. And the kids, actually, away at college, have been using it as their source of calling when they're away from home. But I've got to say the advent of voice over broadband has allowed us to reduce the cell phone usage.
Well, that's an interesting question. Mr. Levinson, what do you think about it? Is these internet calling, is that going to be another version of cell phoning? Or I guess if you're talking about doing it, well, if you're doing it through your laptop, that's fairly portable.
What's happening is everything is merging together. So there's no doubt that the portable internet that we have on laptops is becoming a cell phone. And at the same time, our cell phones are becoming little portable internet terminals. In the end, I don't think it matters. I think within a few years, we're all going to be carrying little devices that do everything. Much like our brains, which are only about a kilogram or so of matter, process all this information. By the way, about George's point about his family, I think that's very well taken. One of the great advantages and benefits of the cell phone is that it does enable members of families to keep closer together. My family lives in New York, but our son is up in Harvard and Boston, and we talk to him probably on the cell phone more than through any other medium.
But George, are you still there?
Yes.
My question for you is, why are you using a cell phone right now?
Because I transit between one office to another.
And so
I enjoy listening to your program at this time.
So you're on the road?
Right.
Okay, and you're driving?
Correct.
Okay, so I'm going to say goodbye now because I don't want you to get into an accident, and then I'm going to ask Paul Levinson about that aspect of cell phone. I know it's a point about whether it's dangerous or not, but it does seem like a distraction, or is this now one of these things like people can listen to the radio and drive and not be distracted?
Well, I think, no, it's not the same as listening to the radio because the radio doesn't ask you questions. You're not having a conversation with the radio, so it's much easier to ignore the radio and focus on the road or just put the radio into the deep background. That said, human beings are inherently multitasking organisms. This was actually recognized by William James late in the 19th century when he said our consciousness brings sanity and clarity to the booming, buzzing confusion of the world. And so I think we can process and juggle a lot of things. I think it depends ultimately on the person. And we do have to be, you know, responsible. If we're driving and we know when the cell phone can be a distraction, if we find ourselves talking on the phone and then realize that we just narrowly missed hitting into the back of the car in front of us, then it's probably a good idea not to talk on the phone. If, on the other hand, we can drive safely and we can keep it into, you know, check and control, then I have no problem with it. I think we need to be careful about laws, you know, that may sometimes do more harm than good. I mean, you know, the idea that you can't talk on the cell phone without a cordless device if you're driving. Well, what happens if a person is driving and has some kind of medical emergency? You know, they feel themselves getting a heart attack or something. I mean, I wouldn't want a law like that to prevent them from calling for help. So in the end, I think we have to sort of evolve into a proper social custom that works for individuals.
I guess there's a temptation. We have an email here that warns us not to become slavishly devoted to our cell phones. He, I guess, writes anonymously, but he makes the point that he says, I might point out that cell phones can A, be turned off, B, be left at home while walking or bike riding, and C, be ignored. The fact that one has a cell phone does not require that it be permanently attached to one's person. So I guess there's that point to consider, but you're saying that people have them and tend to keep them on.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I'm saying people should have the right to keep them on, but they should also have the right, as your emailer suggests, I agree with that completely, to turn them off or, in fact, to not answer them if they're ringing. Because, again, this gets back to what we were discussing before, human beings are entitled not to communicate. Now, we understand this, you know, if we're in a hotel room and we put a sign on our door that says, do not disturb, and, you know, most people understand not to call someone at 2 o'clock in the morning if they have a phone in their bedroom. So we just need to extend that understanding to the cell phone and say it's okay to keep it off.
We need to take a short break. We're talking about the cell phone revolution. Coming up, we'll hear about how cell phones have made mobs smart and talk about the future of cell phone technology. We'll also take more of your calls at 800-989-TALK. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation in Washington. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking about how cell phones are changing life as we know it. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And I have here in my hand the following message. It says, I sent this message from my cell phone. I can toggle between text or email. It cost me only 10 cents to send you this message. I love it. So I guess we have entered the text messaging age, like it or not. I'd like to introduce our next guest by putting us in touch with a world on the move. Cell phones let us do more than just organize picnics or business meetings. They've changed the way we mobilize large groups of people throughout the world. This has led to the rise of what are being called smart mobs. Howard Rheingold has written a book about the phenomenon. It's called Smart Mobs, The Next Social Revolution. He joins us by phone from his home in Mill Valley, California. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And I guess I should ask, are you on a cell phone?
Not at the moment, okay. No. You need a wire line for radio.
Well, you do and you don't. We prefer it, I guess. They still haven't gotten quite the kind of fidelity on cell phones that the NPR engineers prefer for radio broadcasts. But what's the first... I mean, how are people using cell phones to mobilize other people on a large scale?
Well, when I wrote my book a few years ago, I had noted the anti-globalization demonstrations at the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle that was organized by people using mobile phones, the popular demonstrations in the Philippines that brought down the Estrada regime. People sent text messages to each other, millions of them organized within a couple of days, totally self-organized by people sending these messages telephone to telephone. And since the book, we have the president of South Korea elected largely because his constituents used the internet and mobile phone messages to get out the vote. We saw the riots in Nigeria a year ago around the Miss World pageant. People were summoned to those using text messages. And not long ago, after the terrorist bombing in Spain and before the election, a period in which political demonstrations were banned by Spanish law, Spanish citizens self-organized their demonstrations using those text messages. And I think that this is really just the beginning. It's as if you're looking at the PC in 1980 or the internet in 1990. This kind of organization is going to spread, and it's going to become much more sophisticated.
Can you describe, I mean, just in practical terms, how does it work that 3 million people can be organized by cell phone? I mean, it's not one person sending 3 million text messages.
No, you know, there's the telephone tree is an old organizing technique. You call a few friends, and they call a few friends, and they call a few friends. That takes a little while to propagate. You can send a text message to a few friends, and with a couple of thumb strokes, they can send that same message to everyone in their telephone's address book. And they're sending it to people who are not going to log on to their desktop and see their email. They're sending it to people who are carrying their phones with them. And I think that's really an important part of what's changing, is that communication and computation have untethered themselves from the wireline phone and from the desktop computer, and we're carrying them around with us everywhere we go. People are able to organize themselves in the face-to-face world, not just in cyberspace.
Does this organization take place across social classes? Is it only for the people who are wealthy enough to hold a cell phone?
Well, you know, the cell phone in many parts of the world is really the poor person's PC. There are literally people who are barefoot in slums. I've seen them. Certainly many of the people listening have seen them, who are talking on phones. And that's really not frivolous. That's access to information that can make a real difference in their lives. If you're a fisherman off the coast of India, you can now get a text message that says which port has fish and which port you can go to and get a better price for your fish because they don't have them. The Grameen Bank gives microloans to women in Bangladesh who have the one mobile phone in their village. Nice little business for one woman, but it also means that everyone in that village has access to information about the spot labor market. If there's work for two laborers an hour's walk away, now someone can feed their kids where they couldn't before. So I think that this information revolution, because people who never could have afforded or didn't have the literacy to get in on the PC or the internet revolutions, it's going to be much more widespread, and it's going to be in places, such as wherever you carry a phone, that the PC and the internet didn't reach. For better and worse, don't let me paint this as utopian. I think people can organize to do terrible things, as well as democratic things.
We're talking about cell phones and their uses, or possibly misuses. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. And let's go to Lisa in Chandler, Arizona. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a crazy day for me. I've never been on the radio in probably 25 years. And via my cell phone, I spoke with my governor of Arizona earlier today on NPR show. And I'm still on my cell phone speaking to you guys.
Wow, and why, what makes, I mean, cell phone was important to all this because why?
Well, it allowed me, I work with my husband, we own a company, and I'm running some errands, and there was just these hot topics today, and I happened to manage to get through. But I'm very familiar with Latin America, Central America, and I would say cell phones are the great liberator. They have allowed, when I was in Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua 15 years ago, you had to go to phone centers, and it was a very laborious thing to make a call. And they've bypassed the entire need for the phone wiring, and they're now cell phones, and people can communicate. And I think it's a huge liberator. I think that has freed people from having to be ignorant about what's happening out of their little village, their little community and town.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Howard Rheingold, I wonder if you can expand a little on that. How is it that a country that can't afford a telephone system can afford a cell phone system?
It can't afford a wireline system because it's very expensive to put all those wires in the ground. And if you have poor people who are starving, they're going to dig that copper up and sell it. It's much easier, it's less expensive, and you can cover more territory by putting in a satellite station and then distributing your voice messages wirelessly. You put one guard at the station there instead of having to guard all of that wireline that takes years and years to install. That's the reason we've got something like 250 million mobile phone users in China. It would take forever to try to wire them up. And by the way, the Chinese have been very good at using their authoritarian government to suppress information until now. They tried to keep the lid on the SARS epidemic until 150 million text messages were sent in 3 days, peer-to-peer. The citizens there, if somebody sees something happening in one place, that spreads. And let me add that that's a good way to spread good information, bad information, misinformation, and disinformation. So it makes the world porous. It's no longer possible for censorship, and it's also means that the quality control on information is a lot spottier, just as it became with the advent of the Internet.
Let's go to Mike in Portland, Maine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I think one of the issues that comes up with cell phones that happened to take place part of a discussion in a staff meeting I had today is people sometimes take more chances because they have a cell phone, and they think that they may be able to be rescued because of it. One example up here in Maine is people sometimes go white water rafting or skiing or whatever in remote areas with a cell phone and then find out they can't call out. And in a staff meeting today, I work in a halfway house with teenage girls. We wanted to issue them 911 phones. There was a discussion about that, so that if they were in an emergency with a man or with their family or whatever, they could pull out their 911 phone and get help. But it also might make them, we decided not to, because it might make them feel they're invincible, and they take more chances because they think they have a cell phone, and they can get help when they need it, when, in effect, they may not be able to, based on the rural nature of our state.
Paul Levinson, I wonder if that's something you've observed.
Yes, it's a problem, but it's not only a problem of cell phones. It's a problem of all technology. The problem is that technology inherently doesn't work sometimes. For that matter, the same is true of our own bodies. Communication theorists refer to this as noise in the system, and it's unfortunately ubiquitous. And so you always have to keep it in mind whenever you rely on any device. The answer, to some extent, is to have backup, more than one way of communicating. But in the end, you should never you know, put yourself at risk and depend solely on one technology to save you. By the way, I just wanted to comment on something that Howard said before about the use of cell phones politically. It doesn't work all the time, as I think Howard Dean and his supporters found. You know, the Howard Dean campaign was probably the highest tech campaign in American history in terms of use of cell phones and the Internet. And again, for better or worse, the campaign didn't succeed in the end. So what that, I think, shows us is we need more than technology for a political revolution or a political event to occur.
Let's go to Andrew in Lakewood, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just want to give the point of view from the world of education as far as like the high school age and stuff like that. Cell phones are being seen as teachers as more of an epidemic. We get them in classes all the time, and it's not so much kids using them to be on the phone. Sometimes it is a problem. And what's really kind of a riot is when the girls try to, like, tuck it under their huge, like, hair and act like they're just leaning on their hand and they're actually having a phone conversation in the middle of class. But we see an outbreak of text messaging, like, all the time. And, you know, you're talking about something that may be, like, a very sensitive topic in class. Like today we were discussing, unfortunately, the situation in Iraq with the beheading and all that, and then we had just gotten this great breakthrough with the class, and all of a sudden it was interrupted with this piercing cell phone ring, and it really kind of takes it back a few steps. And then once you get out of the classroom, we have the same generation seems to be the new fad in movies, when you're watching movies in an actual cinema, to text message each other during the movie. Rather than leaning over and whispering to each other. So you have this explosion of colored light going on or all around the theater that is like, it's like trying to watch a movie with a fireworks display going off every 5 seconds. So I guess I'm a big supporter of possibly inducing an age limit on cell phone usage. Like, you must be 18 or so to actually have a cell phone.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that at all. I mean, I think the age limit on cell phone use should maybe be about a month and a half of age. Okay. And then anyone older than that should be able to use it. You know, educators have been worried about new media.
But in any circumstance?
Yes, because, I mean, there's no real harm done. Let's just, if you talk about education for a second, I came across an article that was published back in 1910 by William A. McKeever, a justifiably unknown-to-history educator, I think from Kansas, and he was railing on and on about motion pictures. This is back in 1910, saying it distracts students rather than going to class. They sit in these dank, dingy theaters all day. Then in the 1950s, we heard this about television. That was destroying literacy, except for the fact that surveys in the late 70s showed there was absolutely no decrease in literacy. Then there was concern about the Internet, the Communications Decency Act. So now the cell phone is, you know, the new medium in town, which is, you know, what a lot of people are getting exercised about. There's no evidence whatsoever that students are having more trouble learning because they're using cell phones. Sure, you shouldn't have cell phones go off in classrooms while a class is being conducted. But I think in the end, if students have access to more information through their cell phones, they'll probably be better educated. As far as cell phones and motion picture theaters, yeah, I think they're annoying. But I mean, are they less annoying than I always seem when I go to the movies with my wife to have someone who gives an instant libretto about the movie sitting in back of me? In any case, so
well,
I don't.
All
know
rude
that
people
that
should
difference.
Be chastened in all occasions. I think
that's right.
We're talking about cell phones, their use, their misuse, and what's coming in their technology. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'd like to read from an email that from someone named Chad, who writes, I just got back from a 30-day trip to the Philippines and was dumbstruck how many people use cell phones to text. To text, I guess, is a verb now. From executives to maids and drivers, they were much more advanced than the U.S. in this area. They said it's much easier to text than call, where in the U.S. it's vice versa. Howard Reingold, is that your experience? I guess you're not surprised to hear that.
There's something close to 100 billion text messages sent worldwide every month. The U.S. has lagged, and there are reasons for that, but the U.S. is catching up. As we heard the high school teacher talking about it, you know, once your 15-year-olds start using them, it's about 3 years before everybody else uses them. That's what happened in Scandinavia. That's what happened in the Philippines. That's what happened in Brazil. And I think that there's a very interesting generational dynamic here in that there are 15-year-olds. They're in Seoul, they're in Sao Paulo, they're in Helsinki, they're in Rome, and they can probably type as fast as you can with both hands, with one thumb, with their hands in their pockets. They're used to always being connected. They're used to always being in touch with five friends. Now they're sending pictures to their friends. 10 years from now, those 15-year-olds are going to be 25. The technologies they carry are going to be maybe thousands of times more powerful. Unlike the television, which is what the baby boom generation grew up with, or the internet, which was tethered to the desktop, here we have a worldwide generation of people who are used to using the technologies they carry with them to summon social networks, to get the information that they want, to organize collective action, whether it's just to show up at a mall at the same time. I think that that's going to be a very big change 10 or 15 years from now. I'm not decrying it, and I'm not saying that they are less educated. I'm saying that they have a different way of being in the world.
Paul Levinson, I wonder if I can ask you, you have some things you think you'd like to see for the future of cell phones. What would those be?
Well, we want to enhance both the ability to reach people on the cell phone, and at the same time, we want to enhance the ability of people who receive these calls to decide who to talk to and who not to talk to. So in my book, Cell Phone, I come up with a modest improvement for each of these two groups of people. For the cell phone caller, I would love to see a program in all cell phones in which you just spoke the person's name that you wanted to call, and then the cell phone system would search out all possible numbers in which that person could be reached. You perhaps would provide those numbers initially, perhaps they could be searchable through the web, and so the cell phone would automatically just call every single number, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 possible numbers until the person was reached, or perhaps the person wouldn't be reached.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, and for the cell phone receiver, it's sort of the same thing, but in reverse. Of course, we can tell today who's calling if we look and we see a number flashing, but we don't know who is at that number, right? Is it our, mother-in-law at the number who we don't want to hear from, or is it our father-in-law who we do want to hear from? We appreciate...
So a better identification network. Yeah. A better way of knowing who's calling.
That's right. Maybe even just simple voice recognition.
Well, that would be good. I'd like to thank my guest for joining us this hour. Paul Levinson is the professor and chair of communications and the media studies at Fordham University. His new book is called Cell Phone, the story of the world's most mobile medium and how it's transformed everything. He spoke to us from our New York bureau. And Howard Rheingold is the author of Smart Mobs, the Next Social Revolution. He was with us from his home in Mill Valley, California. You can find a link to his website on npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking about how cell phones are transforming our lives. Join the conversation. Call us at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Donna in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that when my son was 15, it allowed us to give him a cell phone and still have the freedom that he wanted, even though we were nervous about letting go. And now that he's 17, he just calls it his electronic leash, but it still gives me the comfort of knowing where he is and what he's doing, and he could tell me a story, but he doesn't.
Do you ever find you're trying to listen to what's in the background when he calls you?
He's usually pretty careful, and usually it's his car. He has a noisy car. But a lot of times we text message, and we found that to be a little bit quicker.
I see. And does he reliably carry it? I mean, that's one of the things we were talking about earlier. You know, it's one thing to have a cell phone. I try to reach my wife a lot, and she lets the battery run down, and it's dead. So having one and actually reaching someone on it are two different things.
Well, that's true, but he's real responsible about it, and he's real anxious that his friends can reach him. And if he's that anxious for his friends to reach him, I told him he needs to be as conscientious about me reaching him.
Okay.
So it works out pretty well. I'd say 95% of the time I can reach him on his cell phone. And he also knows that when I can't, I will start calling his friends.
All right.
So
well, you sound like a conscientious mother, and I congratulate you for that.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Elaine in, is it Heidelberg, Germany? Is that right?
Yes, it's Heidelberg, Germany.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is more a nuts and bolts rather than philosophical, but I have to respond to that last caller because I'm the mother of a teenager who's now in the States in school, and that phone she had was like my lifeline, and she knew if I ever called her and she didn't answer that phone, she was toast. But over here, we don't have cell phones.
You don't?
No, I mean, we have mobile phones, and we have always had mobile phones.
I think, isn't that just a semantic difference?
No, it's not, because our phones are all satellite. Our phones, any of us who have mobile phones here can call anywhere in Europe, Asia, North Africa. And it was very eye-opening when I went to the States last summer when my daughter was starting the university in the States. And to find out about cell phones, and now I know why people talk about cells, because they are really physically limited geographical areas. And we call our phones handies here because you hold them in your hand. There are all these roaming things and different cells and what you pay if you go from one cell to another. And it seems to me that the technology in the United States is quite behind Europe and the Middle East and Asia and North Africa, and I'm really surprised about this.
Right. Well, I believe that, in fact, you are right, that the technology is behind in the United States, but that was one of the things we had hoped to talk about on this session of talking about mobile phones. But unfortunately, our guest, who was going to join us from the UK, where they do have some pretty amazing phones, hasn't been able to reach us. So I'm afraid this is exactly where we'll end this conversation about mobile phones.